I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm joined today by David Zutty. David, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back.
So today we are going to have a stream against gloom and doom because there's a lot of, well, as people like to say, blackpilling going on out there. And I got a message from somebody. It wasn't an email. It was a text message, one of these things on social media, whatever you call them. And this person wrote to me, quote, "Greg, I'm so blackpilled that I am listening to millennial woes and old Pox Populi streams to cheer me up." And I thought, wow, that's pretty blackpilled. I guess it's pretty blackpilled. And I thought, I need to do something to help cheer this guy up and other people up. There's one fellow that I used to see on X, and he's on Substack. He wrote a piece on why he's leaving the right. Forgive me, his name is escaping me. And when I inquired about my friend's black pill, he basically said, Trump has betrayed us so horribly. I had hopes a year ago, we all had high hopes. I was amazed at what a strong start Trump was off to. He was doing all kinds of good stuff. We were finding out about USAID, all that, those scandals. It was quite remarkable. What a difference a year makes, right? He has backed off on deportations. He's basically going along with what the cheap labor lobby says about migrants. He has reneged on the Epstein thing. And what has come out is extremely damning. And then he started this stupid war, the second war of his second administration with Iran. He's done two wars with Iran in the space of less than a year. And this second war seems really like it's going to be quite catastrophic for the United States. It's already been quite catastrophic for Iran and the Gulf states. And patriotic Americans, and especially Americans who identify with the American system and the American empire, which I don't, are going to see a lot of things that they cherish lost in this war. I think we're losing the credibility of our empire. We're losing the petrodollar. We might basically, at the end of this war, be nationally insolvent. And of course, the big worry is that all this stupidity and betrayal is going to put the left back into power. Later this year, we have midterm elections. There's usually a trend towards the party that doesn't hold the White House making gains during the midterms. In this case, there might be a blue wave, as people like to say. And of course, in 2028, when there's going to be a new race, no incumbent, Trump's successor, whoever that will be running against whoever the Democrats put up. And we could see the left returning to power with a vengeance. So these are the sorts of things that worry a lot of us. They're worrying my friend who wrote in. And I want to deal with this particular argument. And then I thought we would open things up to your questions and comments. Folks out there, if you are experiencing some lemons that life has sent your way, why don't you look at the bottom of the screen, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, skip the hyphen, take out your credit card, hit the green button, and send a super chat. We very much appreciate those. They help us pay the bills, keep the lights on. Send us your concerns. Send us some of the things that are bothering you, and I'll see if I can squeeze some lemonade out of it. I am not Dr. Pangloss. Sam Dixon always refers to Jared Taylor as Dr. Pangloss. Dr. Pangloss was the fellow in Candide by Voltaire who believed that this is the best of all possible worlds. I'm not that guy. I think I'm a realist. And I think, though, that there are realistic reasons not to despair once we understand properly what our struggle is, what we're up against, what the chances are. Once we have basically expunged all false hopes and false expectations, unrealistic expectations, I still think that we shouldn't despair. I think we should be of good cheer and we should stick with this and move forward. Personally, last year at this time, I was starting to get quote unquote black-pilled. And the reason I was getting black-pilled was that things were going so swimmingly well in the mainstream that I was noticing a drop off in our own revenue and also in our traffic. I think some of that traffic drop off had to do with Jim Goad, who stopped writing basically in April of last year. So it's been almost a year. So some people were not coming back for him, but I think that the eyes and ears of the movement and the normal people who would be reading Countercurrents were riveted to what was going on in Washington. There's always a tendency for people on the right to get complacent when there's a Republican in office because they think that we're somehow winning. And with Trump, it's very plausible to have thought that. I felt that we were winning, that we were winning on a lot of things. He was doing a lot of the things that we would have done if we had white nationalists running America. That's simply true. And so I was thinking, could Countercurrents be irrelevant or soon be irrelevant? Why would anyone come to Countercurrents, especially given that so many of the ideas that we talked about on the margins of society are now mainstream all over X? And I'm not. I'm banned from X. Countercurrents is banned from X. Countercurrents is banned from Facebook and all these other platforms, while people who have come along much more recently, and frankly, a lot of them are much more quote unquote extreme than I am, they're flourishing on these platforms. I was thinking this could be bad for us. It could be hard for us to stay in the game. And I don't think that anymore. I don't think that anymore because a year has gone by and I can't say anything else than I told you so. The relevance of what we're doing has never been clearer because what's undone the Trump administration is the lack of proper principles. And we're all about getting things on the right foundations, getting to the basic foundational principles necessary to fix the problems that we're facing and understand why these problems have come about. Trump, bless his heart, is not a principled man. He doesn't get ideological politics. He doesn't get consistency. He doesn't get loyalty. He doesn't get a lot of the things that we stress. And he certainly didn't get the Jewish thing. And the relevance of that has never been more clear. And so I think that we're back. We've proved our relevance. We've proved that an unideological guy can only go so far before he gets suborned by his own contradictions and lack of principles. And that's what's happened to Trump. And a lot of people are thinking, well, this is terrible. Trump's going to fail. The Republicans are going to fail. The left is going to come back with a vengeance. Everything is gloom and doom. It's curtains for us. And my first response to this, and you can chime in anytime, David, but let me just give my first initial response to this, is to step back from that scenario and say, let's look at all the players in this scenario. There's the center left. There's the center right, the Republican types. There's the crazed leftists. And there are the sort of populist people on the right like Trump. And you can say there's a Jewish lobby and the oligarchy and foreign powers. They're all playing a role here. But where are we? Where are we in this? We're just spectators. We're just passive spectators here, hoping the Republicans will carry the ball to the touchdown zone, right? We're hoping the Republicans are going to give us what we want. Now, in the short term, that's realistic. We don't have an electoral majority. So if you don't have an electoral majority, you've got to hope that other parties will do some of the things that you would do if you had power before you get power, right? So we're just sort of on the sidelines. We're just passive, waiting for other people to do our job. And no wonder we're depressed, because the guy we thought who was going to do our job isn't doing our job, and we realize he's not our guy. People have been saying that for years. They've been correcting me. They've been saying, Greg, you know, Trump isn't our guy, as if I hadn't noticed that from the very beginning. That might have been the first mistake that a lot of people made. They might have thought that Trump and people around him are our guys. There are these memes about, oh, well, Trump's an old boomer and he doesn't understand, but Barron Trump understands. He's on extremely online. That's just a meme, folks. There's no evidence for that. We don't actually have people who believe the things that we believe in high places yet. And part of the reason why some of my friends are black-pilled is they really think that politics does take place on the plane of parties and fundraising and gaining power. And that's all true on some level. But there's more to it than that. There's more to it than that. And if politics is only material, if it's only about power and money, then it's easy to get extremely discouraged, because we don't have any power, we don't have any money. And they say things like, you got to have money to make money. They say things like, only power can check power. And if that's true, you've painted yourself into a corner, because you're basically saying, if you don't already have power, there's no way of getting it. If you don't already have money, there's no way of getting it. Now, these things are false. And we need to recognize that there's another level on which politics operates, where we do have certain advantages and we have our foot in the door. We're already a huge presence. And that the way to appreciate that dimension of politics is to ask people, what are they using that power and money for? What is directing their usage of power and money, the establishment? Now, you could say things like, oh, their interests. Okay, but where do their interests come from? What defines their interests? If you think that politics is all about money and power yourself, then why are you even on our side? Why aren't you working with the establishment? A friend of mine's dad actually said that to him. He sat his dad down and red-pilled him completely, including about the Jewish question and Jewish power and everything like that. And the thing that his dad said to him is, well, son, why aren't you going and working for them? They've got all the money, they've got all the power. Why don't you suck up to them? Why don't you do like what Richard Spencer ended up doing? Sort of sucking up to the establishment, hoping that they'd forget his thought crimes and maybe welcome him into the fold where all the money and power is. Why don't you do what Patrick Casey is doing and Matt Forney and these other turncoats who are trying to make themselves useful to the establishment? Why don't you do what Captive Dreamer does? Captive With Jews You Win Dreamer. Why don't you do that kind of stuff? If you believe that politics is all about money and power, why are you with us? And the reaction, the natural response that people will give to that is, well, they're wrong. They're evil. I'm not going to join evil. I'm not going to join the wrong side, the false side. I'm on the side of goodness and truth. And at that point, I say, aha. So there are some things that are more important to you than money and power. Truth and goodness are more important to you than money and power. Will you grant the premise to me that maybe that's true of your opponents as well? In short, that the reason why they are accumulating wealth and power is not just to have wealth and power as an end in itself, right? They're not cackling like Palpatine about unlimited power as an end in itself. They believe that certain things are true and good, and that's what they are cashing their money and power in for. They're spending their money and power on things that they think are true and good. Now, if those people in the establishment believed the same things that we believe about the true and the good, their power wouldn't be a problem, right? If they agreed with us about what's true and good, you'd want them to have power. And so the point I'm making here is this. There's a level on which we are not fighting against flesh and blood. We are not fighting against money and power, guns and money. What we are fighting against are principles and the implications of principles that hold sway over the world we live in. It's an ideological war. And we are in that battle. We're fighting that battle, and we have been changing minds. And I can prove it because I've seen our ideas, which are based on truth and are good, moving from the margins of the internet to the mainstream of society. I remember in 2011 when two concepts, two talking points were coined. Countercurrents was a year old. And I remember hearing about this French guy and his term, the Great Replacement. And I remember hearing the white genocide meme from the Bugs people, the Bob Whitaker people. I remember these things being coined. And I remember the slow process of those ideas going from the margins of white nationalism to the mainstream of white nationalism to the political mainstream. And now remigration is being talked about everywhere. Remigration laws are being debated and passed. We have a party that's been launched in the UK this year, Restore Britain, which has put out a big proposal on remigrating millions, literally millions of recent arrivals who do no good to society. And they've laid it out very, very radically. The memes about remigration are so radical on the mainstream platforms that I, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, would have soft-pedaled these things. And now it's just out there in the open. People unapologetically saying they all have to go back, and I don't care if they're citizens, and I don't care about anchor babies, denaturalize, send them all back. It's everywhere. That's progress. We are winning in the battle of ideas, and ultimately it's ideas about what's true and good that determine how political power is used. And if that's the case, then I don't see any reason to be gloomy about this. We're still in the game. We're still winning in the battle of ideas. And if the worst case scenario that a lot of people have been entertaining, yes, the left gets back in power. They basically Nuremberg Trump and his followers, they shut down all discussion online and so forth. The worst case scenario comes to pass. Guess what? Liberalism still won't make society better. Multiculturalism still won't make society better. Open borders, ignoring black crime, reckless globalization, none of these things will be making society better. And therefore, we're still going to be relevant. Now, we might face new obstacles and hurdles, but we're still going to be relevant. And even if it's harder for us to communicate with people, there is still the push factor. We're pulling people towards us, but the system's own contradictions and breakdowns and heinous consequences will continue to push people in our way, especially if the left doubles down. So I don't despair about Trump's betrayal. I wish it hadn't happened. But in terms of the battle that we can actually fight right now, we're letting mainstream parties fight in terms of money and power because we don't have the money and power to compete with them yet. But some of our ideas are becoming competitive in European countries very rapidly. That's an important thing to bear in mind. But until then, we have to hope that these people will be receptive to our ideas and implement the policies that we would implement if we had power. There's every reason to think that that's still going to be happening, because we are winning these battles and more people are coming to our side. And I can measure that. I can measure that in terms of things like web traffic. I can measure that by looking at the rise in references to certain terms. I can measure that in terms of news stories where our ideas are being discussed more and more. So I think that that's my main reason for not despairing. So David, I want to turn it over to you. What are your thoughts?
So all this comes down to expectation management, where people expect, just like the original alt-right, people thought there would be no Empire Strikes Back. You know, the Soviet Union didn't, it fell rapidly, but it didn't fall without sacrifice and ebbs and flows. And I'd also remind people that they probably haven't actually sacrificed anything personally that bad, unless you count economic effects from the oil shocks and the economy just being generally bad overall. But you haven't gone to, you know, solitary confinement like a lot of the J6ers have, like Joel Davis, Rob Rundo. So if you look at your life personally, it's not that bad. This, yes, it's very depressing, as in, oh no, people are not surrendering immediately to us. This is not a Disney movie where you do a little stupid song and dance and the bad guy loses with magic. No, this is like, you need to think about Spengler and reality, that no, there's struggle, there's a historical process, and history, sometimes, you know, years will happen in weeks, but sometimes there are slowdowns, there are back and forth pushbacks. If you're a black belt, imagine what you'd be like, say, in the middle of the, you know, 1989 fall of communism, or Rome during Sulla's prescriptions, or the wars of the Tremvirs. This is actually pretty, there is one thing that does make it more black plane, which is a great replacement, because even if you have like half of everybody's dead in like ancient Rome, at least it's still Roman. Here, there is a great replacement ticking, and we feel like we're running out of time with that. And also society is just, it's no longer recognizable. But overall, personally, it's not that bad. I don't want to sound like, how does this affect you personally? But let's be real, you're not in solitary confinement. You may not be able to make your mortgage payments, but you're probably not literally starving, as in you can't literally eat food and your ribs are sticking out like you're in a concentration camp, you know, a gulag or something. It's more of a spiritual struggle, which means you have to be able to take ups and downs well, and sometimes maybe break away from the news. And too, a lot of people, what happens is that, like you said earlier about, you know, are we going to be relevant? A lot of Wignats are terribly black-pilled originally with Trump. And a lot of this came down to how they had this idea of victory in their head, that this would be basically Third Reiching their way into power. And Trump was preventing that. And they didn't like their electoral politics. They didn't like the GOP. If you looked at how they were acting earlier up until the war started on February 28th, which there's also some astrological stuff going there if you want to look it up, they were just whining and crying and all this stuff. And now they're just having the time of life because they've been vindicated. And it's only because they were so wrapped up with Third Reiching their way into power, as opposed to looking at other things like circulation of the elites, you know, infiltration. I'm very much method agnostic. I preferred the infiltration method, but I'm done with it. Obviously, this is unforgivable as a matter of honor. But yeah, I'm fine with this. This is actually a terrifying curveball in some ways, but it's also a very pleasant one because the GOP just destroyed itself. It has completely annihilated its legitimacy, and this is after the Democrats also destroyed their legitimacy. So this makes it a lot easier for us to either start a third party, start a voting bloc that can demand things from the other two parties. And what happens is that these two parties openly declare, we're going to basically destroy the other one and make it illegal to exist. We have a lot of leverage over them where they need us to do that. And we can make demands that way. Also, we can remember how evil the GOP was. Remember how Trump abandoned the J6ers. you know, Chamber of Commerce, Open Borders, Maxine. The GOP likes to present itself vaguely as being pro-white, but implicitly, but they're actually very viciously anti-white. And so those of us who have dealt with it, people, for example, I think this is wonderful just for a personal reason, because the Jewish Federal Society, which is just a bunch of neocons and cucks, you know, they were rather rude to me when I was doxxed. And so I think it's wonderful. I hope that people in the Federal Society are, you know, maybe thrown into solitary confinement. I don't think it's going to be that bad when the left takes power, but if these people are subpoenaed, they start losing money, they get scared about knocks on the doors, their email accounts are subpoenaed, they have issues. I think it's wonderful that they have to deal with a little bit of anarcho-tyranny for once instead of just us. So that's wonderful. And that is a they problem, not a we problem. And even though I wanted to use the Republican Party as an instrument, there are a lot of good people in it. However, those are mostly all young people who are marginalized. I'm not attached to it. It was simply a means to an end. I'm not attached to the Constitution, rule of law, any of these things that people get connected to, including the Republican Party. I simply saw it as a tool that was useful. And now it's useful for delegitimizing itself and Judaism, the Chamber of Commerce, big tech, and the evangelicals. Like, there is something of a religious war heating up, kind of in general, but also in the Pentagon. This is Easter weekend, and what happened is that they had a Protestant service for Good Friday in the Pentagon. Well, there wasn't a Catholic one. The Catholics don't have a mass, from what I've heard on Telegram and from people who are Catholic, but they have like some type of like generic service, and there wasn't one. And the guy, there was a associate of Pete Hegseth, his name escapes me now, but he said that he doesn't think there should be Catholic processions in America. And this is a very anti-First Amendment stance. I wonder if you would say the same thing about Islamic or definitely not Jewish displays of religiosity. And he singled out the Catholics. I wonder if you said anything about these like monkey statues the Hindus put up. And yeah, but that individual was invited to speak today, or he had some type of role in today's Protestant function at the Pentagon. Well, this is good because it's going to destroy the evangelicalism. It's become totally repugnant, and I would prefer that America not be Christian, but if it is, it should be Catholic, because it's the one thing that has doctrine, and therefore it puts a handbrake on these ridiculous notions like dispensationalism and the Scofield Bible. Catholic, or maybe, you know, Eastern Orthodox, or maybe actual old school Lutheran, because that was the original Protestantism that didn't go full retard. Luther was trying to simply reform stuff, not create 32 different flavors of heresy or start worshiping Jews. In fact, he wrote a book denouncing the Jews. But I think that's where we're at. We have a lot of dumb stuff self-imploding and destroying its own legitimacy, such as evangelicalism, the GOP, Zio-cucks, boomers, Trump. It's over for them. It's not over for us. And you just need to pretend that this is Hearts, Iron, 4, and imagine if instead of playing our side on this, you had to play the other side. It'd be a lot worse.
So years ago, I said something that I stand by today, that there are only two groups of people who really understand what's going on in the world today, and those are Jews and white nationalists. Everybody else out there in politics today is wandering around with their heads, let's just say, in the clouds. They're not fully cognizant of what's going on. They're not fully cognizant of what is at stake. So let's go back to this battle of ideas that we're talking about. There are other forces. There are other opponents out there. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think there's any so fundamental as the organized Jewish community. And the issues that we have to face, the ideological issues that we have to face, are basically hatched and pushed by organized Jewish groups. You know, the destruction of our identity, open borders, all of this kind of stuff. It's been weaponized by the organized Jewish community to a huge extent. And even to the extent that these bad ideas didn't get hatched by, say, the Frankfurt School or whatever. They certainly have been weaponized by them. And when you try to oppose these bad policies like open borders and things like that, you will rapidly find that it is very well-funded Jewish groups that are lining up on the other side. Therefore, I do think that it's reasonable to believe that the fundamental battle here is between us and the organized Jewish community. And, well, let me ask you, are they stronger today, morally, intellectually? So they're certainly very strong in terms of money and political power, but are they stronger morally and intellectually than they were a year ago or 2.5 years ago? I don't think so at all. I think that they are very weak, very exposed. There is widespread disdain for the horrible abusiveness of the Jewish community towards the rest of the world, frankly, and certainly their willingness to, let's be just honest here. There are going to be people starving all over the planet this year because of the Iran war. Because not only is it interrupting the flow of petrochemicals, it's interrupting an even larger percentage of the world's urea, which goes into fertilizers. There's going to be famine in the world. Millions may die. Maybe 6 million people will go hungry this year because Israel wanted to destroy Iran. They got their loyal lapdog, Donald Trump, to sign off and go to war with them. And the catastrophic consequences are going to lead to the deaths of millions. Why? Even the New York Times admits that this was all for Israel. It's all about destroying one of Israel's rivals in the Middle East. That's it. They got such power, though, and they are so reckless and evil in the usage of it that they're willing to impoverish hundreds of millions of people, disrupt the lives of billions of people, and condemn to death perhaps millions of people, just for a little bit of geopolitical advantage in their neighborhood. That's just evil. This is flat out evil, and it's totally exposed. I look at this as a great opportunity. Starting with the Gaza genocide, Jewish sympathy in the world, susceptibility to their bullshit started declining rapidly. And now this, where the mask is off, it's totally open, a war that can have absolutely catastrophic consequences was launched by this tiny, tight-sized little nation and its international diaspora for the most selfish of reasons, and they don't care about the consequences. They don't care about the consequences. All the consequences were totally predictable to them. They don't care. So let me ask you, is Trump's betrayal on this a bad thing or a good thing? Well, in terms of politics, in terms of the election cycle, in terms of other stuff we wanted to get out of Trump, it's a very bad thing. Maybe it's a crisis. In terms of the intellectual battle against what I believe is the principal enemy, I think this is an enormous opportunity. I think this is a gift that's been handed to us on a silver platter. So again, I'm not all doom and gloom about this. I think that this is actually a tremendous amount of progress. Also, although my preference was to unwind the American empire in a slow and deliberate way, unwind the petrodollar system, which is frankly, it's just America acting like Shaniqua with the EBT on the dime of the rest of the world, with, you know, the petrodollar system. I want that to go away. That's just a source of corruption. Bread and circuses for America by basically rigging global markets. And it's all based on a bluff, based on a promise that Trump couldn't deliver on, namely protecting these petro monarchies. So they use our dollars and basically allow us to carry huge deficits every year. So I want these things to go away. I didn't want them to go away in a sloppy way, but look, nobody listens to me, right? Nobody does rational stuff. Nobody learns from other people's mistakes. People don't look at history. History is a long record of other people's mistakes. Smart people learn from other people's mistakes, other people's suffering. Fools only learn from their own suffering. And unfortunately, we're ruled by fools. And that means that the lessons that get through, if they get through at all, are dimmed into their heads by suffering. And Americans are going to suffer a great deal, but it's going to dim it into their heads that, well, with Jews we lose, for one thing, but the whole American system and its relationship to the world was ultimately immoral and unsustainable, and it's going down. It's going down, and it's going to be messy, brutal, bloody, impoverishing, but in the end, it's going to be beautiful.
Right. This has to be done. It's one of those things where it's a teachable moment, and they always say, like, Weimar conditions lead to Weimar problems. Like, I'm sorry, Weimar problems lead to Weimar solutions. But if we look at this, this might be necessary. One of the most refreshing thing about what's happening is that the Zoomers are totally cynical and jaded, so they don't believe these big lies anymore. Usually people say that's a bad thing to say, it's refreshing because you don't need to push back against, well, what about my constitution? It's, no, this is about power. It's almost like they're picking up like Eastern Bloc characteristics from like the Warsaw Pact, which is good because people in the Warsaw Pact aren't fooled by communists or Democrats or big slogans, at least less so. And I did some, if you want to know about the petrodollar, I did some math with Grok. Instead of making AI slot videos, I used it to do geopolitical research. And what I found is that if, instead of having the petrodollar, if America borrowed at an interest rate which was would be fair based upon its economic reality and not the petrodollar, it'd still be pretty low interest rate because that was a lot going for it. But, and then also assume that they didn't cut any spending either. Well, the debt to GDP ratio would not be 124%, it'd be somewhere between 140 and 160%, I think. Definitely 140% minimum, probably higher, like 150%. And that's big because it was actually less than 1% of the budget each year that would have had to be put onto the debt. But the thing is that this is compound interest. Anyone who's played the New Order mod for Arts of Iron 4 knows this. This is one of the things you like to play with in the economy in that game. And yes, well, a lot of gamers probably know more about economics and geopolitics than Trump does. And that's why he should be removed from power. We should stop electing businessmen because businessmen suck at politics and war. But it looks, if you look at it, you would have to have cut Social Security, welfare for Shaniqua and EBT, a lot of nonsensical stuff, or defense, which is really just offense. We should stop calling it that. Like, one of the good things that the administration did was that called the Department of Defense the War Department, because it actually is what it is, and we stop pretending otherwise. But you would have had to make difficult decisions, and by putting off these difficult decisions, America is actually in a weaker state. Imagine if Americans had been forced to say, yeah, instead of now, we're bankrupting the country for Shaniqua and banks. If they had to confront that reality, say, in the 90s or even the 80s, the petrodollar goes back to the 70s, at least with the stats that Grok used. Well, if we had to confront these issues in the 90s, we may not have gone full retard. We may not have had acquired these pie-in-the-sky views about American exceptionalism, where we don't need to balance a budget. We can bomb people and they don't shoot back, which is ridiculous, and it's very Jew-coded. So this is actually good. We need to get realistic about who we are and that we are not exceptional. We'll become exceptional by acting as if we are not and acting responsibly and intelligently, not just thinking that we're entitled to win because we exist, which is a good way to be defeated, actually.
Folks, if you have questions and comments, and if you have some of life's lemons that you'd like us to squeeze some positive things out of, please do send us a super chat. I'm going to just check over at Entropy. Our friend RW has sent $25. Thank you. He says, people can agree to disagree, but over specific policies. However, people will kill, die, and sacrifice for ideologies, belief systems, and worldviews. Ideals are peaceful. History is violent, or at the very least, often acrimonious. Question, given how Donald Trump has completely betrayed us, do you regret voting for him? Oh, okay, well, that's an easy one. No, I don't regret voting for him at all. I voted for him 3 times, and in each case, he was definitely the better candidate. So to the extent that voting matters at all, and it does matter in the aggregate, each individual vote may be subtractable, but if they're all subtracted, of course, everything is different. So voting doesn't matter all that much to me as an individual, but I did it anyway, and I don't regret it. I just didn't think there was any real choice in the matter. Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris. Clearly, he was better than all of these candidates. And he actually did some of the things that we would have done if we were in power. And that's just the truth of the matter. And there's no reason to regret that at all. But now that he's really screwed everything up, do I wish I'd changed my vote? No. Honestly, no, I don't. I think I made the right decision. I didn't expect that it would all fall apart so quickly or so catastrophically. But honestly, if we were going to have this war, I would prefer that the war go badly for Zog. And I don't want American soldiers to die. I don't want anybody to die. But I don't have the power to stop this war. And if the war starts again, since people don't learn from what's good, they only learn from suffering, I want this to go as badly as possible for the evil, stupid people who did this. And so, again, I just think of this as a great opportunity. I don't think the mask would have been off about Jewish power half as much if Kamala Harris were president. But what a joke that would be. What a painful experience that would be. You know, I had lots of friends in the UK who went 0 seats on the Tories, and I totally get it. But, you know, I said to them in all candor, once Labour is in, you're just going to be astonished at how awful these stupid people are. And believe me, I had no idea that they'd be as bad as they were. So yeah, you can go 0 seats on this stuff, but somebody like Harris would have been absolutely awful and not necessarily in constructive ways. So no, I don't have any regrets about voting for Trump. And I'm not sure what I'm going to do in 2028, if there even will be presidential elections then. A lot of things are changing. But I'll just vote for the lesser evil. And that, my friends, is the definition of rational choice in a real world. You look at the different options that are available to you, and you pick the best. And that another way of saying you pick the best in a imperfect world is you pick the least bad. It's the same thing. The best of the available options is also the least bad of the available options. I have no apologies for voting for the lesser evil. And there's no way that we're going to get better choices, I think, by not voting at all, not participating at all, unless we can become a powerful voting block. But then what that means is we're changing the choices. We're changing the things that are available to us. And that means that we're shifting from being a consumer, right? You walk into the voting booth, you're consuming, right? You're choosing. You're choosing one party or the other, one candidate or another. It's just given to you. Choices are given to you. You make the best of it. What I want to be and what we need to be and what we're focused on is expanding the choices that are available. First and foremost, that's an intellectual battle because we have to get people thinking, well, yes, we should have more options. I don't really like either of these things compared to this third thing, which isn't in the offing yet. That's our goal. Our goal is to create new options for people, to make new options possible, conceivable. That's what we're up to. And one of the ways that we can start doing that, once we gain a certain amount of size and cohesion, is we can start becoming a voting block. And we can start throwing our weight around. And we can start expanding the options that are available. Ultimately, I'd like there to be parties that are competitive, that represent our ideas. But it begins with the intellectual battle. And that's what we're in now. So my attitude about voting, again, shouldn't be interpreted in a way that only thinks in terms of us being spectators, that only that's only conceived in terms of us not being agents, right? We're agents. That's our goal. Our goal is to change and broaden the range of what's politically possible so that we can gain political power ourselves and stop having to hope that people in other parties, very flawed, confused, unprincipled people in many cases, will do the things that we want to do. We'd like to be able to do the things that we want to do ourselves in a position of power someday. And so I look at making choices in existing elections as a very tiny thing. I don't depend upon it. I'm not betting the store on that, not at all. And if you think of yourself only in that way, of course it's depressing. I just think of it as a minor civic duty. And because the whole country is discussing politics around election time, it's an opportunity to insert our ideas into the political conversation. That's why we talk about what's happening in the news, basically. That's why we talk about elections and candidates. Ultimately, it's because we want to expand the available political options so that white survival is a real political option that we can vote on, right? And then the ultimate victory is when white survival becomes the common sense of the whole political spectrum. So you're not allowed to vote against it, basically. No matter who's running, they're all for white people. That's possible. We know it's possible because for a very long time, everything was stacked against white people. So we just need to reverse that. David, yes. Do you have any thoughts in response to this? In light of his betrayals, do you regret voting for Trump?
Absolutely not, because there may not have been a shortcut. Let's assume that in an alternate reality that Kamala Quisha had won. Okay, the country would continue to decline and would have gone browner. Okay, let's say that then eventually in 2028, what would have happened in 2028? Would Trump have been disgraced, you know, convicted, impeached? No, what would have happened is that he would have run again, and he would have betrayed us again in 2029, probably. And that's simply how it is. He seems to have been, I hate to sound paranoid, but the Wignats and the Groypers, who were really, really anti-Trump, they were kind of vindicated that maybe he was plotting against us this whole time. Maybe that isn't paranoia. Maybe he's such a weird boomer Jew that I do think at some level he's converted to Judaism, or he's trying to tag along with Chabad Lubavitch. But he would have done the same thing, but this would have only happened 4 years later, and it would have been browner and gayer and stupider and more dysfunctional and more impoverished. So we would be in a worse position and later on. This had to unfold. And if Trump hadn't run, people would say, like, either he would become senile, impeached. But what happened is that the MAGA party would have stayed around. What happened, I've been reading multiple books. I get all confused and takes me all to get through them because I have multiple ones going on at the same time. But in Richard Syme's book, The Roman Revolution, he talked about how killing Caesar didn't matter because the Caesarian party, you know, stayed on. It was a whole patronage network, family, friends, patronage, relations. And killing the head guy didn't take it down. It just meant that, you know, at some point they kind of did kill the moderate Caesar and they got the radical Augustus. But if Trump either became senile, was assassinated, was impeached, whatever, his party would stay around. So just because he's impeached, well, or convicted, what he could do is that he could just appoint somebody. And that endorsement, as he is my avatar and I give him my full blessing, there might be a few people who wouldn't have voted for that person, but a lot of them would have. A lot of people would have still voted for him because that's Trump, and they'd be under this delusion that orange retard would still be for this. And we have to understand that this MAGA is a cult of personality. Yes, it's around one guy, but it's also an interest group of Jewish interests. So Trump would have simply redirected his cult of personality to this new guy, instructed him to pardon him, vindicate him, and basically be his way of getting back at the establishment while he golfs. He probably would have gone all in on this simply to get back at the establishment for dissing him. He desperately wants to be accepted. And then his successor, whether that was J.D. Vance, whoever, would probably have done the same thing. And even J.D. Vance, I had high hopes for him because he plays Magic the Gathering. He's younger. If he can't stand up to Trump now, he wouldn't be able to stand up to Trump and the Jews later on, even if he didn't initially intend to betray us all, as Trump probably did. So no, I don't. And two, it's good because it's destroying everything. It's clearing the path. I'm on the warpath against Trump. Like the whole thing with Gavin Wax, that, you know, Trump coddling this doxer. No, I'm on the warpath against him. I want to burn MAGA down and the GOP down. So this had to happen. If he hadn't been elected, he wouldn't have been able to reveal the true form of the Republican Party himself and MAGA.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. If he hadn't been elected this time, he could have stuck around or had a proxy, and we would have been going through the same awful stuff, and we would be, things would be worse off demographically, politically, probably. So, good point. Let me just see here if there are any other questions. Yes. Dalriada has sent $150 US. Wow, thank you so much. That's extremely generous. There's no question attached. But we are delighted to receive your questions and comments. Ah, and I have a few more. A disembodied voice speaks and sends $10. Thank you. Greg, if racism is the worst sin ever, as we're told every day, then let's end racism once and for all by having different groups of people separate, blacks can go back to Africa and never hear the N-word again, never have a microaggression again. Isn't that an amazing offer? Yeah, it's an amazing offer. And I agree with that. Archie sends $7. Thank you. I have many friends who know the facts but accept white extinction. They feel that nothing can be done. They fear financial sanctions and legal battles. Well, yeah, this is selfishness on their part. They're just looking out for their own life. And they think, well, you know, white extinction is inevitable, but it'll happen long after I'm dead, so it's not my problem. I think we can actually make that attitude work for us to some extent, because what we'll tell them eventually to ease the way into power is, look, folks, you can just golf and watch Fox and, you know, attend meth orgies at your old folks' home and stuff like that, whatever. Because the world that we're creating, where white people have a future again, It's going to take a few decades and you'll be dead by then anyway. So don't worry about it. Just relax. Just grill. Do whatever you want at the old folks' home. And shut up. Get out of our way. So I do think that that's one thing that we can do that, to leverage that incredibly, how to put it, irresponsible attitude. Of course, a lot of the people who say this would still give money to the National Trust for Historic Preservation and Save the Tigers and stuff like that. They will support things that are directed towards making the world a better place after they're dead, but they'll never do that for white people because they're very conventional. And as the last questioner said, racism is the worst sin ever for white people. So Archie sends another $7. How does a man balance ideas and honor against the need to accumulate wealth? Katie Hopkins is in financial ruin for her efforts. Tommy Robinson is rich. Musk is a conundrum. Well, I mean, that's a good question because that's how we're ruled, right? The system, put it this way, thought experiment. If you are creating a system where you are going to genocide a certain troublesome group of people in your society in a slow and stealthy way over a few generations, how would you make that work? Well, you would find a way of making them enjoy the ride and making them afraid of speaking out, making them think only in terms of their own selfish personal interests and not in terms of the greater long-term interests of their group. That's baked into Western societies with extreme individualism and stuff like that. And the one of the ways you do it is you just make sure that everything's fine and people can be affluent and have their careers and their vacations and whatever. But if you cross the line and talk about what's happening to your people, we're going to come for you and we're going to take your job away. We're going to take your fortune away. And that will keep people in line. If you're the kind of person who puts your own personal interest ahead of what's right. So they're presupposing that you are a selfish, dishonorable person. Unfortunately, most people are selfish and dishonorable. What kind of people can't be ruled by that sort of system and kept quiet by that sort of system as they're being destroyed? People who regard some things as more sacred than money. Truth. The right thing. And that's the ethos that we've got to inculcate. We've got to inculcate the idea that, yes, it's important to pay your bills and leave something for your kids, etc. Be a good bourgeois. There's nothing wrong with that. If you're going to have to work and everything, you might as well have a job that pays well and live comfortably, et cetera, et cetera. But you cannot be the sort of person who will allow flagrant, world-destroying evil to run amok because you're worried about money. You have to teach people to feel like they would be lesser beings, contemptible beings in their own eyes if they were to do that. I gave a speech at the American Renaissance Conference last year called Our Sacred Honor. And I talked about the American founders. And I talked about how these terribly bourgeois people, and they were terribly bourgeois, were still revolutionary because they weren't entirely bourgeois. And the thing that set them apart from the bourgeoisie is that they were willing to risk their lives and their fortunes, but they weren't willing to compromise on their sacred honor. There was something sacred that they were not willing to sell out for money or personal safety. And that is the ethos of the revolutionary. So we simply have to inculcate this revolutionary ethos, because people who have that ethos are not governable by the current system that threatens their livelihoods to basically get them to shut up and go along with their own extinction. David, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so the belief that you can avoid this all, it's very silly. The idea that this will not be determined victory or defeat by the time you die is a very cowardly optimism and a huge assumption. And we know what happens when we assume things. Who knows what's going to happen? I don't think we're on. I hate how right-wing podcasters always talk about the civil war happening to get people riled up for quakes. But I think there'll be some type of decision or revolution or movement or moment, an hour of decision, you could say, where this will be decided. And it will be before a lot of these people who think that they will be gone will be gone. It will be while they're alive to some extent. Or do they really think it's going to be complete, you know, will the whole thing happen after their death, or will it happen gradually? Like, do you really want to run up in a nursing home with an angry black woman? You know, that could happen to you long before white people are genocided, like in South Africa. And that's a big problem. Do you want to have Social Security cut? We just lost the petrodollar, and, you know, money's going to have to be cut somewhere. Trump is talking about cutting stuff, social benefits and all that. So that has to fall somewhere. And who, you know, boomers have had a lot of power, but so do blacks. Maybe they'll split it equally. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll raise property taxes really high. Get whitey. Get you. And honestly, a lot of young whites will not come to your benefit, to your help, because they don't own a home. And we could work together and say, hey, we will defend your right to Social Security, or at least having some type of UBI as we phase out Social Security, because it's basically a dumb Ponzi scheme and irresponsible, and people can invest their money better. We won't allow you to be homeless, and we'll make sure you're provided for at some level. But you need to help us with getting young people a house, getting young people, especially young white men, jobs. We can help each other, but they don't want to help. So a lot of people will not be coming to their aid if their Social Security is cut, or if they start taxing unrealized gains. A lot of young whites don't, unless they're in cryptocurrency, that's not something that affects them, unfortunately. Or property taxes. This idea that you'll be gone is a huge assumption. And these are all horrible things that can happen in declining society while you're old. And two, one of the good things that if you're older, what you don't have to worry about losing your job. People call you stupid names, we'll just call them a name back. Like, I went to a multicultural middle school. Someone calls your mama fat, you call their mama ho. Just, you need to have that attitude and get over this bourgeois daintiness. Like, who cares what these people think? They're stupid and inferior. Is going to their cocktail party really that fun? Is it more of a chore? So you're just getting rid of a chore. That's where I see it. And also you get a lot of benefits because you'll be remembered well. There's a lot of glory and opportunity to be had here if you do this. And too, like, people think that if you donate, somehow Mossad figures out with Oracle or Palantir magic and they'll send ninjas after you. That's not how reality works. But like, there are ways to protect yourself. And that's it. Like, there is a lot of stuff to good, and there's a lot of bad stuff that could happen too.
Mm-hmm. So I was chatting earlier with a friend, and he gave me a few blackpilling things that he's facing. And so I want to address some of these things, because I'm sure that a lot of people are experiencing this as well, especially if you're very online, especially if you are on X and you are looking at comments, especially on X, but on other platforms as well, because it does seem to be the case that the replies, the comments, are getting stupider. And he said that he feels like the bad has driven out the good to an extent. Now, I absolutely agree with this. This is not true at Countercurrents, by the way. The quality of the comments there is, I think, pretty consistently high. But in a lot of platforms, especially less curated, less censored platforms like Countercurrents, There is definitely Gresham's Law at work in the commentary section, where you just have cranks and idiots and self-indulgent people just lowering the quality of things. There's no question about it. I've seen that trend. And that is that's a bad thing. But the one good thing I can say about this is that this is a sign, this is inevitable if our audience is growing, right? Because the way a movement like ours starts out, and at the core of it, it is an intellectual movement. Even the anti-intellectuals are taking an intellectual position. Even the people who say, you know, enough of this talk, we need to actually do something, they're still talking on the internet, right? It's an online intellectual movement. And movements like that begin with people who are more intellectual. And as they expand into the fat, rich, increasingly mediocre, middle of the bell curve, right? And so what you're going to find is as our movement gets more successful, and it is getting more successful because we do have a bigger audience, the audience on average is going to be dumber, less educated, less civil, if that's even conceivable that things could get less civil. It's going to get less civil, folks. And yeah, you can bemoan it, but it is a sign of growth. That I do think that that's one bright side of this. It's the only bright side I can think of. Another thing that he brought up, and this is absolutely correct, is that the online attention economy is very perverse in its incentives. And so you find a lot more slop. And that's true. And I think the major driving force behind slop is, well, it's X, and it's Elon Musk monetizing X. Suddenly you get people who are just throwing out stuff there to get reactions. The worst of them, the worst of the worst. Well, there are all these AI slop accounts from South Asians, right? You know, basically just click farming people on the right. But the worst of the worst is someone like Richard Hanania. He's just a malignant narcissist who just thrives on negative attention. And he's monetizing that. And I think that that's bad. Obviously, if I could get Elon Musk to do anything, I would have him just rip the monetization away from X. I think that that would eliminate one of the major perverse incentives for lowering the quality of discourse. David, do you have any thoughts on this?
It'd be nice if they manipulated the algorithm in a good way to promote good discourse. And maybe we don't control X, but maybe if someone were to give us a large sum of money, we could do something where we could encourage people to provide better, higher quality content. But I almost wonder if maybe the slop is intentional at some point. It's not just about making money. I mean, Elon has to make money too, even though he's a trillionaire. There is the ADL boycott, which is quietly dropped, by the way. But, you know, I think we need to start providing good incentives, because if we don't, people will provide bad incentives, or simply the market will determine stuff. The market is just slop. Like, I believe it was Benoit, I was reading his book about how capitalism is actually very, it's always been kind of woke. If it will peddle something that will sell, it'll sell it to make money, even if it's not in good taste. So I think that's what happened, and Elon is way too much in the capitalist market camp of the right wing and not into higher stuff, despite kind of playing with it sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. There has to be a way of upholding standards. And the trouble is that economic competition is a race to the bottom in terms of bastardizing standards. Because again, if you have high standards, fewer people are going to click on it. Fewer people are going to get engaged with it. And that means less money. The only way that you can set up these high standards is to insulate them from economic competition. Basically, what you need is you need patrons of extremely good ideas who don't have to compete for clicks with the Stu Peters of the world, right? And they can uphold standards. And then I think that you can have free speech, but as long as standards are upheld, it's going to have an effect on the broader culture. And another thing is to, and we can't fix this until we're in power, but better education would basically just disarm slop entirely. People would have better taste. They'd have bullshit detectors. They would not be taken in and fooled by this stuff. And so they'd be immune in effect. But anyway, I definitely think that there have to be some ways of upholding cultural standards. By the way, one of the most influential books I ever read in getting over liberalism as an ideology was Culture and Anarchy by Matthew Arnold, who was a 19th century English poet and critic. And basically, it's an argument for why liberalism in the realm of culture is the royal road to the decline of standards, to the bastardization of standards. And therefore, it's an argument for the state insulating high standards, high culture from economic competition. He even goes so far as to argue for an established church, because an established church doesn't have to compete for adherence, and therefore it can uphold high standards. Whereas if you have a free-for-all in religion, and you can simply look at the United States for that, it's just a breeding ground for absolutely bastardized doctrines. You know, prosperity gospel type stuff, Christian Zionist type stuff, megachurch type stuff, rock and roll ministry type stuff. If you have an established state church, they might not be able to compete for, you know, clicks and views and asses and seats, right, with these sort of vulgarizing churches, but they can at least uphold a body of doctrine and not be tempted to just throw it overboard. Whereas in America, we have no state church, and therefore it's just been for free for all. And basically it's a race to the bottom, and Protestantism is the bottom. So anyway, let's look at some more questions. We got a bunch that have popped up. Thank you. Okay, $3 from a disembodied voice. Thanks. He says, I agree fully with David Zutty on Trump too. It had to unfold, as Harold Macmillan said, events, my dear boy, events. Events unfold and enforce changes. That's very literate of you. Thank you very much. Friedrich, our friend Friedrich, writes in with $25. Thank you. Hello, great show. For some reason, something in force since January 1st has been pushing to the fore on X. German men aged 18 to 45 are not allowed to leave the country for more than 3 months without permission from the Ministry of Defense. That's troubling. Keep up the good work. You'll never be irrelevant, in my opinion. Thank you. I wonder if they are keeping the migrants in the country like that. I don't think so. That's an interesting point. I saw Martin Selner post about that today. So in 2011, this is from Archie, who sends another $5. In 2011, at age 88, Lee Kuan Yew said that prosperity hasn't made Singaporeans soft. Prosperity has made them self-centered. Yeah, I can see how that is the case. Prosperity is something that you all want it. Face it, you all want it. But it has to be constrained by another kind of ethos. And if it isn't constrained by another kind of ethos, then what you have is a very placid, wealthy society of sheep, basically. And if you want that kind of society, well, you just give them prosperity, and they get denatured really fast. But I want to live in a free society, a republic where people are responsible and participate in politics and things like that. I think that's the best form of society. And that means that it's got to find some way of dealing with the enervating effects of wealth. David, do you have any thoughts?
I'd say that it really need to be. I think we are going to have to deal with some type of decline, or managed decline has become a bad thing. But I think there can be too much wealth, and America is definitely too wealthy for its own good. Like, yes, people should be able to afford a home, but the decadence of the 90s led to, the millennials being weak, and now we have all this. The 50s led exactly to the 60s. So I think between, being impoverished in Yugoslavia and being an American in the 50s, there's some type of middle ground there that we can aim for. And a lot of it might be culture. If we're going to be wealthy, we might need to have to impose something top down where it's combat sports, it's fitness, it's aggression. If we could indoctrinate people with good stuff, we could maybe mitigate the effects of wealth. But that would require like movies, video games, TV. Sport, most importantly, sporting and stuff in real life. Also, a culture, including a cancel culture, that would not put up with weakness or stupidity and would root it out. But that would have to require some type of elite, like a party, to enforce that, or bullies. Like, people have realized that maybe the bullies had a social useful function. I was never a fan of that, picking on people, but maybe they had a point. Maybe that was the only thing preventing the whole country from falling apart was bullying people. And if you don't bully them, they become trans. I don't know. But that's something to consider. And speaking of migrants and, well, them leaving, maybe them coming in, Trump did another dumb Truth Social post where he said, and it sounds good at first, but he said, if you import the third world, you become the third world. Oh my goodness, guys, based. And reverting to caps, because why not? And that's not going to happen to the United States of America as long as I am president, President Donald J. Trump. Well, he still allows H-1Bs to come in. I mean, yes, legal migration has fallen off, but it's still a thing. Deportations have slowed down. And also, if you bomb the third world, you become the third world. This, like you said earlier, this is going to cause a huge famine problem, and this will be used as a pretext for migration. It's a long cycle of bombing the third world, importing the third world, and we're supposed to break it. But this will be used as a pretext. Now, maybe America or Europe or select countries will have the willpower to say no to that and say, no, I don't care if you're starving. I don't even care if I caused you to starve. We're going to do our own thing, but we'll see what happens with that.
So we were talking earlier today about something that was kind of remarkable during the Second World War. There was a labor shortage in the UK, and one of the things that they did was they took crazy people who weren't totally crazy, like drooling, gibbering, crazy people, but people who were institutionalized, and they gave them jobs helping, driving ambulances or helping people find air raid shelters and stuff like that. And the fact that they had something serious to do in their lives sort of snapped a lot of these people out of it. I do think that there is a enervating effect of not having serious things to deal with. Having something serious to deal with makes you serious and draws something out of you. And people who just, they go through their lives like shopping and having tea parties and macaroons and Instagram posts and stuff like that, it's bad for the soul. I'm thinking of this one woman in particular, but it's just bad for the soul. It just makes you superficial. It makes you self-indulgent. It makes you slack and weak. And the trouble with that also is it makes you crazy and neurotic. Well, it starts out neurotic, right? The most neurotic people I know are the people who were pampered And they have wealthy people, spoiled children, whatever. People, wealthy people can act like spoiled children, and spoiled children act like spoiled children. What's the problem with that? Well, they become dominated by their whims, and they can cater to their whims, right? If you have an obligation to do certain things and you follow through on it, that's actually good for you. If you suddenly have a little bit of anxiety, a twinge of anxiety about this trip that you promised to take or this thing you promised to do, and you can just throw money at it or ghost people or do what people do these days to break obligations or never actually gain any obligations to begin with. Well, what does it do? It just makes you ruled by your whims, and being ruled by your whims and not having obligations you need to meet is just a royal road to softness and neurosis. And eventually, when these neuroses get worse and worse, it can make you crazy. So I can see where affluence and a lack of serious needs and obligations, an emergency, right? Something to make you focus, is really a bad thing. So let's see, we have a bunch more questions here. This is very gratifying. Folks are actually chiming in. Thank you. A disembodied voice writes in with $3. What's going on with Magyar Péter, the pretender to the Hungarian presidency? Something about a sex tape. Is this a hoax? Okay, well, I've been sort of watching the Hungarian election, which is what, 8 days away now? Because frankly, I root for Orban Viktor. I'm rooting for him. And this other guy just strikes me as empty. He's basically the Gavin Newsom of Hungary. I don't think he stands for anything, but he wants power. And he used to be a member of the Fidesz party, used to be a party insider. He had a falling out with some people in the party. He went to one of the oligarchs who's a major Fidesz donor and said, "Back me. I want to run for PM or president," or he wanted to move up in the party, and the guy said no. So at that point he decided, "I'm going to create my own party." Well, that's a very bad sign right there. The guy's just motivated by personal ambition, not necessarily principle. There's a significant number of Hungarians who are not particularly fond of Orban for ideological reasons, the libtards, okay? And others are just kind of sick of him because he's been in office for 15 years and they don't remember how horrible things were before he was in. They don't appreciate that things have gotten better under his rule. Even though the country's been, thrown huge curveballs like COVID, which its economy still hasn't fully recovered from. There's been terrible inflation and all that kind of post-COVID nonsense. People don't remember that, especially younger people. And, Orban's just sort of this fat old man now, this fat old guy who's been around for a long time. And I think that there's just a certain amount of, how to put it, disaffection with that. People are bored, right? It's just boredom. They're bored with this guy and they think maybe we should have a change. Maybe things will get better somehow. So, I mean, this is what's driving this guy. There's the left that wants him, Orban out. And so here's a guy who's photogenic. He's nice looking. He speaks well. Totally unprincipled, but still, he's not Orban. So the left is supporting him, centrists are supporting him, muddle-headed people are supporting him, the board are supporting him, and he's doing well in the polls. Honestly, my feeling though, if I had to bet money on it, I think it's about 50-50, the chances that he'll win. But I think in the last week, the polls will close up tightly, and that Orban will probably squeak by. And he'll squeak by doing cheesy things like giving sacks of potatoes to gypsies and 20,000 forint notes to drunkards to go to the polls and vote. Yeah, but everybody does that, and that's just retail politics, and he's actually good at that. My sense is that he'll probably squeak by. It would be very good if the people who are ideologically opposed to him from the right either stick with him or vote for the Mihazonk party, which is the quite right-wing party. I'd like to see them get more votes and have more seats in the parliament, because then Orban might be forced to actually form a coalition with them, which would be great. He might actually have to give cabinet seats to some of these people. And some of these people are quite radical. And there's stuff on Countercurrents about that party. So that would actually be a good thing. And this party understands that they can lead from a minority position, basically by putting out ideas that the Hungarian public likes, that are rightist ideas, and Orban will steal all the good ones and run on them. And they understand that they can lead that way. And if they're actually in a coalition where they have to be accommodated and even given cabinet positions, ministries, I think that would actually be quite good for the right. Hungary would take a right turn subtly, but it would be a turn to the right. So that's my hope, that it'll be close. Orban will have to have a coalition with the further right, and that this fake candidate is going to just fold up at the end. Now, I think Orban's campaign is not particularly inspiring. Basically, the slogan of the Fidesz party is a safe choice. Not the best choice, just a safe choice, right? And there's this sort of saying that, like, the Hungarian national sport is complaining and blackpilling, but I don't know if pitching it in such a way is the best thing. Maybe that's the vote he's going for, the people who say, well, I'm not sure, but this is a safe choice, right? Maybe they've got the data. Maybe they've polled people. Maybe they know that's going to work. But that's my thought. I think that it's going to be close, but I think Orban could pull it out at the end. And if he does pull it out and has to have a coalition with the further right, that's actually a really good outcome for us, for people like us. So, David, do you have any thoughts?
Not particularly. Just this will have some implications for American elections. Now, we have to be careful about translating lessons from one country to another. Hungary and America are two very different places. But this, if Orban doesn't do well, that could indicate that running on a purely negative campaign, like I'm not Kamala Harris, I'm not Trump, is not a winning proposition, even in a country as cynical and blackpilled as Hungary. And so simply saying that you're not Gavin Newsom, you're not J.D. Vance, is not going to be a winning thing. Whether or not people in America take note of that, including people who are paid a lot more than I am, who knows? They probably won't, because they're stupid or they have evil agendas. But the Mihazonk angle is good, because that could imply that something could happen similarly in America. And a lot of people don't like Orban. Well, if you don't like Orban, do you want to go with some new guy who you don't know, or Mihazonk, where they're not Orban, but they are a safe choice too? So that's, in a way, Mihazonk is a way to get the best of both worlds, both safety and a shakeup of things. And a lot of this might be caused too by this. Orban isn't just running against his opposition. He's more running actually against Zelensky and Brussels. And yes, Brussels is evil, but the main thrust of the anti-Brussels stuff is Ukraine. And it's just weird. It's like this weird thing to double down upon. And I don't know if it's all that popular with people. I would assume it's a very strange thing to do electorally. Like, I would, you know, part of Peter Maggio's thing is that he's not going to double down the Russia boost stuff. So we'll see what happens with that.
Right. Yeah, he's running. Orban is running against Ursula von der Leyen and Zelensky, plus Peter Maggio. It's bizarre. It's odd. I hope he has polling that can back this up as a strategy. but it seems really kind of odd to me. And I just don't know if Hungarians are going to vote against Zelensky, right? My feeling is that people see Zelensky as a somewhat noble, embattled figure in a country that's right next door. Now, the Hungarians have like border disputes with all their neighbors, and there are people on the right who are, you know, put out about that kind of stuff. But more broadly, it seems to me that Hungarians would probably be happier. I know Romanians are happier at the idea of another big country between them and Russia. You know, they don't want Russia on their border, and Ukraine is a great big country between them and Russia. And I think that a lot of them probably would be quite content if Ukraine remains a big buffer between them and Russia. So I just don't know. Yeah, we have more questions here. Okay. Aaron writes in with $20. Thank you so much. The launch of Artemis II is white pilling. Agreed. All the more so that certain factions of the left are skeptical and outraged by it. Thoughts? I haven't followed it all that much, but being an American, I love machines, and space exploration stuff is very appealing to me. And yeah, it seems like a distraction in a certain way from the things that need to be done here. But honestly, I think it's glorious, these technological achievements. And so I'm happy to see that happening again. I wish this was routine. I wish we had never stopped doing this, just stayed in practice. But you know, it was the welfare state. It was black people, you know, that basically caused the left to turn against the space program. You know, the thought that all that money could be basically sent to slums rather than putting Whitey on the moon, as Gil Scott-Heron said, it's just sad. It's really sad. It's quite emblematic of how the left is anti-civilization, anti-technology, anti-glory. So I'm glad that this is happening again. I want Whitey to go back to the moon. I wish Whitey would build a base on the moon and just stay there. Anyway, David, thoughts?
It's one of the few good things that is going on, and that's, I really wish Elon Musk had not been sidelined. He's not aggressive enough on pushing back against this war, but briefly it looked like we were going to have a technological renaissance, but that's imperiled now. And Elon's kind of an idiot because he's so focused on that, he doesn't realize that if Trump messes up the politics of America so bad that there's a huge, the Democrats take power in 2028. We may be able to prevent that, maybe not. It'll probably require Tucker running. But if the Democrats take power in 2028, they will go after his businesses. They're going to lawfare him and find every little issue that's wrong. They're going to cut his government subsidies, which is going to destroy it, and definitely no more Whitey on the moon either. So,
yeah,
he should be a little bit more concerned about this.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one reason why I'd like to see Orban win, because who knows, in a few years' time, people like Elon Musk might be upping stakes and fleeing to a country like Hungary just to avoid, well, the left, the crazed left coming back into power with a vengeance. I don't know if a country as small as Hungary would really welcome the richest man in the world, because he would have such an outsized influence immediately on everything. But, you know, it could happen. So let's go forward. We have many more questions. Thank you, folks. Disembodied Voice writes in with $5. Thank you. Greg talks about honor above self-interest. That is something an open-minded or eccentric person would have. I don't want that to be eccentric. I want that to be the norm, right? Our movement is known to attract open-minded people. It seems that we have the right human capital. They just need a push. I agree with that completely. So Gadius, welcome back. Gadius Maximus. He writes in with $20. Greg, isn't what's happening in the Middle East ultimately a good thing with respect to the American empire? Is Orange Man bumbling the West into a better position despite himself and the Hebes? Am I just coping? No, you're not just coping. I do think that this is a good thing in the end. Like I said, I didn't want this war to happen. Wars are evil, right? I wanted Trump to focus on pressing domestic concerns, not start a stupid war. Given that he started the war, I want it to go as badly as possible. And, well, Trump's helping out. Pete Hegseth is helping out. These people are absolute, total fools. They have bungled this so badly. And I do think this is the beginning of the end of the American empire, the beginning of the end of the petrodollar. And it's certainly the beginning of the end of Jewish power to just, you know, basically send America as its attack dog. I think this is good. We're finally getting to the point where we might be able to just eject this parasite from its position of power. And that would be a great thing, an absolutely great thing. So, yeah, I don't think you're just coping. I do think that this is the best possible outcome given a stupid choice that should never have been made. He made a stupid choice. He shouldn't have done it, but he bungled it so badly that this is actually a huge opportunity for us. David, what are your thoughts?
No, I think we should exploit him. And remember, this is the guy who threw us under the bus after Charlottesville. I never got embittered as a lot of other people did. How I didn't experience that directly, but he threw us under the bus, the J6ers. Let's turn it in his face. Let's throw Trump under the bus. Like this is our chance to completely turn upon him and destroy him. And just today, there was a poll released saying that his support among white men without college degrees went negative for the first time in his entire history as a politician ever. That's huge. Like, we have the ability now to not just destroy Trump, but maybe to destroy the GOP. And two, the Jew naming is huge. Like, the fact that you have people putting stickers up with the Jew pointing at the price at the gas stations, that's big. Like, this is a point where I've been completely vindicated, where before I was canceled, I bet if I were to go and find past acquaintances and started, like, talking about this casually, catching up, that I could probably get them to admit that I was onto something. Like, we're winning, we're being vindicated. We suffered so bad, but now we're going to win all that political capital. We were the right ones. We fought this, we called it out. And now we're gonna be the original ones who started all of this. Like, and remember, the hippies were originally like these little disheveled freaks and kept out of academia and all that, but then they were the ones who had the Gucci, you know, appointments at college and all that, and they were the ones running society. That's going to be us in a few years, probably. And that's thanks to Trump destroying himself and the GOP and the Jews and the evangelicals and the capitalists and the rest of the swine.
I completely agree with this. Let's move forward. You have some more questions here. A disembodied voice yet again, $5 US. Thank you. I believe the way to make people more heroic is to enforce hardship. I'd enforce 1 month of hardship per year. No internet, no meat, forced to live in the woods. I like that. Everyone would take it in turns. We'll always have entropy to fight, even after we win. Yeah, I agree. There's a wonderful essay by William James, the great, I think the greatest American philosopher, called The Moral Equivalent of War. And what he argues is that war is a horrible thing. There's no question about it. It's terrible waste. Usually they're fought over stupid things and cause immense amounts of suffering and the destruction of culture, and take that as read. But there's something about the war. There's something about the emergency situation. There's something about contemplating putting your life on the line for something greater than yourself that is morally tonic. And we need the moral equivalent of war at all times. We need to build that into society at all times. And I agree with that completely. And there are lots of ways that that can be done. But we have to think how to do that. Because again, peace and plenty can be extremely bad for the soul. They can be enervating. So what's the best thing? War? No, the best thing is to find a way of combining peace and plenty with the ethos and the energizing effects of having serious things that might call you to be above yourself. Now, if you're searching for something like that in your own life, why not white nationalism, right? If you're already listening to us, you found something that's worth fighting for. And yeah, we all recognize that there are people out there who literally want to kill us for our beliefs. And we need to contemplate that. We're literally putting our lives on the line for what's true and good. Some more than others, of course. You should just do it to the extent that you're comfortable. I'm not trying to get people to be foolish, but I would like you to expand your comfort zone at the same time. But that is, I think, enormously good for us to contemplate that we are putting our lives on the line for something that's sacred, something that's worth more than our lives. And I think that people who don't have that in their lives are missing something. And I pity them. And I think that they become, you know, diminished and passive people. Now, I'd like to get some of these people out of this mindset and on our side. If they don't have what it takes to be on our side, fine. I want them to become, just remain passive, and we can just shift them around like sacks of potatoes sometime in the future. I'd rather have passive people than active, principled enemies. But I want more people to be shaken out of this mindset and to join us, basically.
Yeah, a big problem here is that they only see the negatives here, but I think of your problem is if you could have a crystal ball and tell people when victory will be achieved, what we would have to pay, they would go all in on it. It's just the uncertainty that scares them, but they're not just avoiding danger, they're also avoiding opportunity. And they're going to, I think, deeply regret not getting involved, and they're going to curse how they were scared. You know, there's some saying in World War II, like, you know, do you want to tell your grandkid that you shoveled crap in World War II, son? Like, that's how they try to get people involved. Like, do you really want to remember? And, you know, if you're asked by friends or family that you did during the Great Meme War, will you basically cry out in your safe space? That's going to be embarrassing.
So I want to start summing this up. We're about 15 minutes from the end. And the basic message I just want to put out there is, for those of you who invested a lot of hope in Trump, don't despair. He was never our last hope. Years ago, this friend of mine that I only knew under the screen name Raiden said something very wise. I think it was in 2016. He said, Trump is their last hope. He's the system's last hope. He's the system's last hope for somebody who can come in and stop it from destroying itself with complete full retardation. And I thought that was a good point. I thought that was a great point. He was never our last hope. He was a guy who has lots of Jews amongst his in-laws. And that was always the serpent in the garden from the very beginning, was Kushner. But there are many other connections that were equally questionable. Now, I must make a point here. I must say that I do know for a fact that there are certain Jewish individuals, and partly Jewish individuals, who would basically sign off on my analysis so far. I know you're out there, you know, not all Jews and all that, right? I know you're out there. But there's something you've got to understand. I said this to a half-Jewish guy last year during the 12-day war when he brought this up. I said, I understand what you're saying, but given current events it is impossible for me to make that case, right? It's impossible. And I don't have the capital to make that case. And now, given current events, again, even more so, it's just impossible, you know, to make the case that not all, and yeah, I mean, that's just a proviso, understood that as read, but people aren't going to buy it. Even if I tried my best to make that case, they're not going to buy it. There's this meme out there. There's, it was an attempt at branding, a negative branding thing. It was just a manipulation. People in the BAP sphere and others, people want to be people, mainstream people like Patrick Casey, that turncoat. They were talking about, they were poo-pooing low IQ anti-Semitism, right? Okay, fine. I recognize that there's low IQ anti-Semitism. I recognize that there is absolute paranoid, batshit crazy anti-Semitism. No need to deny these things. They're real phenomena. Just read the comments on my latest article at the UNS Review, right? Paranoid, batshit crazy stuff. And low IQ. It's there. It's real. But let me just lay it out. If Trump had been a paranoid, low IQ, batshit crazy anti-Semite, he wouldn't have made this terrible mistake. He, America, and the world would have been better off. And there's a lesson in that, which I think is very important, namely that prejudices preserve us. Even low IQ prejudices, because after all, you need the low IQ prejudices to preserve the low IQ people, right? If low IQ people have a superstitious horror of poisonous snakes, they're not going to be coddling poisonous snakes, and that will save them. If they have a low IQ superstitious horror of making deals with Jews, making a dope deal with Jews. For a long time, there were people in our movement, and they're still pushing this meme, that look, we can make a drug deal with the Jews, right? We can have our closed borders. We can get our country back, and we'll underwrite them performing another genocide in their neighborhood, right? Dope deal. It's a drug deal. It's kind of nasty, but we can do it. It's quid pro quo. I'm sorry. All that is over. No one's going to take that seriously. No one's going to take seriously this attempt to brand anti-Semitism as low IQ and grotty, because the truth is that we would have all been better off if the grottiest, most paranoid, batshit crazy, low IQ anti-Semitism had stopped this war. And so, you know, being broad-minded and fair and accurate on this issue, it's just not politically possible anymore. Things have hardened up, and I think that that's, you know, that's just the necessary way that this is going to be. The boundaries are hardening. The idea that we can make a dope deal with these people and have them in our coalition and stuff like that, I just can't make that case anymore. Even if I wanted to, even if I tried my best, I couldn't make that case. I would put all of my capital on a funeral pyre and destroy it to try and do that. It's not going to happen. That's something that we need to face up to. But let's go back to Orange Man and all this stuff and the situation, not to despair. Again, there's the plane of money and guns, right? There's the plane of electoral politics. There's that plane. We wanted Trump to advance our interests on that plane, and he screwed it up altogether. But we were always playing on a higher plane, because what directs the money and the guns, the political power, the political process, are ideas about what's good and true. And we have the best ideas on this. And again, if Trump goes down in flames, it's still not going to make liberalism work. It's still not going to make multiculturalism work. None of that is going to suddenly be vindicated. Some idiots will try and argue that point, but it's not going to work. So we just need to keep pushing. Don't despair. The second thing I would say, basically, is never hold on to the murder weapon, to put it metaphorically. Trump was a tool. He was a tool of policy at best. Barring that, he was what Charles Murray called our murder weapon, the murder weapon of white middle Americans against the political establishment. And he's been a spectacularly useful murder weapon. There's no question about it. And again, I've been saying this for years, but if Trump's only accomplishment was simply running back in 2015, simply coming down the escalator and saying globalization and open borders are not a great thing for a lot of Americans, and I'm going to fix that problem. That was great because he basically destroyed the agreement that the whole system had not to compete on those things. He put those things into political play. He created a space for us. I don't think there's any reason to believe that things are going to go back to business as usual before Trump. A, business as usual will destroy the country. B, business as usual has driven millions of people to be receptive to white identity politics. That's not going to stop. They're not going to suddenly become liberal Democrats. And C, whether because of principle or opportunism or a blend of both, there are a lot of new national populist politicians who are emerging who are much more principled than Trump. The best example is Rupert Lowe in the UK. JD Vance might be a better example, but because he's a heartbeat away from the president, right? Trump could drop dead tomorrow and he'd be president, the first extremely online president. But again, he has been so tainted by Trump that in the current climate, I don't have the political, the social, the intellectual capital to make a case for him anymore. And so I'm just gonna be quiet about Vance. But Vance might have played the game too well. He might be too close to Trump, and I just don't have the capital to advocate for him. But there's every reason to think we're not going to go back to business as usual. There's every reason to think that more people are going to be receptive to our ideas, and therefore, and there's every reason to think that our principal enemy has never been more exposed and vulnerable. So I'm just going to say it, folks. I am not gloom and doom at all. I'm very, very encouraged by this. I wish it hadn't happened quite this way, but what's happening is good and necessary. It's the kind of stuff that we would have done in a cleaner, more humane, less panicked in all caps, tweets, sort of way. But it's something that we would have wanted to happen anyway. And it's accelerated things. It's accelerated things far beyond what I thought was going to happen. So that's my basic advice. Drop the murder weapon, meaning just detach from Trump. He was a tool, nothing more. You have to regard him as coldly as I do. You can't get too much sympathy, too much affection for the guy. He doesn't feel it for you. It's a one-way thing. You're nothing to him, and he should be nothing to us anymore. He's dead to me. He's a murder weapon who has been very useful. But the wise guys always say, immediately dispose of the weapon, right? Crime done, weapon in the drink. We just have to drop the weapon and continue forward. And what do we continue forward on? What we've been doing all the time, all along, that's the battle of ideas. So that's my case for not despairing. So David, do you want to wrap this up?
Yeah, I think this is a huge opportunity. We're winning. And along with, we have two crises going on here. I think I mentioned it for the American Free Press newspaper. It's that along with having a crisis of competence, they've also now have a crisis of legitimacy. And they can't recover from both. I think people are going to be emboldened by seeing just how stupid the so-called pseudo elites are, both on the Democrats and the Republicans. These people are stupid. They're incompetent, they're evil, and it's going to be very easy to sweep them out because they're not just hated for being strong, they're also despised now for being weak. I mean, not just hated for being a bully or vicious. Now they're also despised for being weak and losing, and everyone's pointing and laughing at them. So I think it'd be very easy to make some big plays in the future.
I agree with that. I'm just checking to see if there are any questions or comments here that we should deal with in the last couple of minutes. So there's a guy, New 124, says, I met loads of Hungarians abroad who hate Orban. I say to them, in 50 years, Hungary will still be Hungarian. Why do you oppose that? I was visiting Hungary back in, I think it was early 2018, and I was on a tram in Budapest. And this Hungarian lad, he was college age, spoke to me, and he said, "Oh, how do you like Hungary?" I said, "I love it." And he said, "Oh, the government here is horrible, blah 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 blah." And I said, "So you're one of these Hungarians who thinks that Hungary would be improved by fewer Hungarians?" And he just got all angry and huffy with me and rolled his eyes. But that's basically what all that just boils down to. Oh, we love diversity. Oh, you think Hungary would be better off with fewer Hungarians in it? Why in the world would anybody sign off on that unless they're just completely addled? So yeah, but there are a lot of people who they have an inferiority complex because they measure everything in terms of money and technology and stuff like that. And Hungary, like all these other Eastern Bloc countries, was retarded for two generations by the effects of the Second World War and communism. And they've got a lot of catching up to do. But and they look to the West and they feel envy and they feel an inferiority complex, but they have to get over this inferiority complex because although they don't have the wealth of the West, they do have other things that the West has lost, and they should appreciate those things. Okay, I'm just going to see if there are any more super chats here. Folks, we are out of time. You've been very generous. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and your donations. And we will be back next week. We're going to be doing something a little different next week, though. I am going to be giving a speech, and it's going to be roughly at the time of this stream. And I thought, well, I'll just pay somebody to do a stream for me, right? I'll get Woz to sub. He'll be actually substituting the following week. But next week, on the 11th, you're going to tune in to Countercurrents Radio around same time, and we're going to start a speech by me, and there'll be some responses and Q&A and stuff like that. So it'll be something new, and it'll probably last 40 minutes to an hour. But we will be back with a slightly different format a week from now. And so in the meantime, just keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you. Thanks for the donations. Thank you, David, for helping out. I really appreciate your takes. And again, we'll be back.